So between chief justices and senators and governor of Idaho, then Lynn Jordan. He lived there. He had a sheep ranch on the Snake River. His parents and grandparents, and when he became governor, and so he had a love for the canyon that even Idahoans that won't vote for 1 acre of wilderness or anything, they could not overcome Lynn Jordan because he lived there. He wasn't somebody that was just trumped up to.
Yeah. What exactly is the nub of the issue about Hell's Canyon and how it should be preserved? If you had to boil down the reasons for preserving it so that it's not damaged any more than it is, what would you say?
Well, it's just that when you know how many million years that it took to bring about the canyon and the evolution of over those millions of years, and then think that those millions of years can go on, there isn't another canyon like it in the world, and the value of it in its natural state will be in the same ratio that it has proven in the last 45 years since its protection to now. Of now we're almost to where that was many 660 some million thousand acres could be loved and enjoyed, and we're getting managements for most of the resources are just about to be a reality, because we plan to change agencies and favor National Park Preserve designation, because they don't log, they don't graze, they really truly give recreation its fullest potential.
Is there legislation underway to make it a national park?
We are, Rick, we're drawing that up right now, and we need to be sure to visit with him. He's asked us, so we assume you, not to be very public with these proposals till our ducks are all in a line, and then we have the support that we will. But that's what we've had to come to, that conclusion, that we won't be any better off in the next 25 years than we have been for the last 45 years.
What do you think are the current threats to the Hell's Canyon?
There are dozens of grazing allotments that not even old historic fifth generation ranchers want to work that hard to reopen these discontinued grazing allotments, but the Forest Service is promoting them because then they have more reason for their jobs, and so they have an EA out that Forest Service is proposing opening up for bids on many grazing allotments, which would be just a national disaster.
Would these be continuations of the homesteaders' grazing areas?
Yes, there would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are they back to where they were originally now, or close to it, do you think?
Are the ranchers or the...
No, the grazing areas. You said they were practically demolished.
There's been some recovery, but there's been lots of noxious weeds, star thistles, cheatgrass, Medusa grass, a lot of these foreign grasses and vegetations have taken over a lot of the ranges, so they only appear that there is desirable vegetation, but they're not 2% of what the original native vegetation, the bluebunch wheatgrass and the lots and lots of shrubs and forages are not there, and because of these foreign invaders.
And the foreign invaders got a hold because it was overgrazed.
That's it. Yeah. That's exactly right.
So what does it need? Just to be left untouched, or the noxious weeds killed and then let the other come back?
The star thistle, because it's a very hardy, very invasive, they have been spraying vigorously for the last 10 years.
That's a good thing.
And not really, but we haven't really, but we've nearly every noxious weed plant has a predator. So we've gone back to the Mediterranean and brought the predators for these noxious weeds and introduced them.
Insects.
Yeah. And the insects are now doing a good job of getting established. And that is the best hope, because the use of chemicals is always a real serious detriment to unknown damage to other native vegetation. So conservationists are very reluctant.
On that subject, I think, related to it, I think I read not too long ago that they need a qualified botanist to classify the various plants that are in the Hell's Canyon.
Yep.
I gather then that this has never been done.
There's a, I don't know why I can't think of it. Charlie Johnson is one of the best plant ecologists there is, and he's written several books this thick. But he is a Forest Service employee, and he does do his job, and nobody can do it any better, but that's as far as it goes. The book is put on a shelf. It's got a half inch of dust on it, and that's tragic.
Well, that why are they apparently looking for someone to do a botanical study now? I thought I read that until that was done, they couldn't proceed with some other plan for the...
I'm not sure the technicality that they have of improving or getting a more thorough study made.
That's what I thought
but
it was.
In every case, we have brought to their attention that they're not doing their job by not having a good biological study made, an ecological survey, and so we hired a lady, doctored, and she, Mary O'Brien, went out and she really twisted their tail on their shortcomings. So Charlie has supplemented his studies to combat her being able to call to his attention that he hasn't done his job. So, and we're evidently possibly going to redo this it again, and probably go to court.
Well, if there were a complete botanical study done of plant life in the Hell's Canyon, would that in some way help the argument that it needs to be preserved?
Yes, definitely.
Because, well, you said Charlie Johnson's book sits on the shelf covered with dust.
Yes.
So why wouldn't a more complete botanical study meet the same fate?
Because we have a lot more educated public that writes letters, and they, in turn, really make it uncomfortable for a public agency to not do the job that they're required to do.
So it's just more evidence of how precious the resource is?
It is more evidence.
Yeah, yeah.
We have a unique very unique thing that even real good scientists are skeptical, and it's called a... I wouldn't have any trouble. It's microbiotic crust. A microbiotic crust on a the vegetation, the soil at the roots of the vegetation, topsoil, and these foreign invaders cannot get by a natural biodiversity or microbiotic crust because it's repellent. But not where it's been overgrazed, it's been the ground has been abused and terracing, where the animals on steep ground make a trail and a trail and a trail. All that breaks down this microbiotic crust. And just giving the soil a 30-year, 40-year unabusive domestic animal grazing, that microbiotic crust will come back. And then there's mosses and lichens that grow right on this biotic crust that is all nature's protective way. Mm-hmm. And that, you can't get one Forest Service person, not one BLM, to recognize this, because all of their friends are cattlemen, livestock people. So they just ignore it and ignore it, but they can't ignore it any longer. Mm-hmm. It's just a known fact. You can just say a road grader goes up on a road, a primitive one-way road, and throws a berm of dirt to each side, and then here, and there's white top is a highly invasive. It just and yellow star thistle gets on those berms of disturbed dirt on the shoulders of those roads, and right at the last little bank of dirt, and here is this all this noxious weed thriving, and it can't get off that shoulder of that road onto this on this biotic crust that is protective, mm-hmm. And yet this it obviously, because it spreads everywhere where the ground is disturbed, but it can't penetrate nature's shield of protection.
So I'm getting the impression that it's the cattle interests that are the main threat at the moment.
They are the main threat.
There's no longer a threat from the power industries?
Nope, there isn't. That's exactly, it is okay. Just exactly.
And how strong are the cattle interests?
Not nearly as much as it has been, because as I started to explain a while ago there, they don't want to work that hard, and the cattle markets are worse and worse and worse every year. The demand for their product is they're not healthy. Mm-hmm. Our doctors, you look nice and slender, and I know you don't eat a lot of
right.
That's right, and that's what's happening. Yeah. And so, and really, it shouldn't have ever been grazing out on those kind of. Yeah. Because actually, I don't know why a rancher, I have a ranch, 200 acres, and my sons were FFAers, they five boys, they raised all the livestock they wanted to, but the neighbor was official, 2,000 acre, was in my Boy Scouts when I was Scoutmaster, and we amateur cattle raisers are competing against their legitimate operation, and why they support anybody that wants to raise a cow, I don't understand. They don't need to. And I don't think they are going to.
Maybe they'll just give up and go away.
That's exactly
what they will.
That's what is happening. No. Mm-hmm. No, it is.
Sounds like the problem is getting smaller and smaller.
Yes. That's a problem.
Right. How about tourists? Are boaters and hikers and so on, are they much of a threat?
No, they're promoters, and they don't appreciate the bank of over 100 jet boats swarming the river, very unaesthetic, for every reason there is. Mm-hmm. There, you know, and so, but we've been to court, we've been just short of the Supreme Court trying to get rid of them, and we didn't make it. The courts didn't favor us on.
So what's your ideal about how the canyon, assuming it can be preserved, should be enjoyed? How would you do it? Or how would I do it best?
We had at our dedication, or at our 25th anniversary, we had lots of new faces come. They said, do you realize we need more access to the river by more roads, and because you only got about four that are, and otherwise you got to get in one end of the river and float through it. Well, we know that. it made us think real, real hard, and I'm not sure we really came up, but they were people. There was one from Michigan, one from Maine, and one from Florida, and they had just, and there they stood on the rim looking into the most vast canyon in the world, and but never ever, they just, if you build that road from where we're standing down there, I'll come back next year and go down and see your river.
They want to walk 100 yards and no more?
That's it. That's exactly what it amounts to.
Are they saying there should be handicapped access too?
Well,
get a wheelchair up to the river?
And yes.
And I've heard that argument.
And they have. Yeah. You're exactly right. Yeah. But we really explain, well, you walk down your Appalachian Trail for 150, 200 miles, and then the segment of it the next year for your vacation. But because you're standing and looking into the deepest chasm, you're saying you're not sure you're up to it. But when you walk down the Appalachian Trail, you don't feel that you're intimidated, I guess.
Well, except for people who want to go on a boat down the river.
Right.
A raft. A raft or a mm-hmm. kayak. Mm-hmm. Do you really need to get down into the canyon to enjoy it?
Nope, because it's a whole, that's why I have 17 horses and mules. Rick specializes in floating on the river. I specialize with all of my family and all my friends of just riding these 2,000 miles of trails that were all built by the homesteaders, and the Forest Service maintained, kept up and identified only a fraction of those, but then we just go ahead and find and explore trails that are between the trails that are between the trails.
Then you can see the river from most of those?
The neatest vistas, mm-hmm. and it just makes your old heart mm-hmm. just throb, you know.
Are there camping places there?
Oh, always.
And you approve of camping?
Oh, absolutely. That's what it's really, mm-hmm. that's really what the Forest Service is hindered that happening, and it should have been 100 times the magnitude in 25 years than it is now.
Because if you camp there, you appreciate it more? Is that it?
You do.
Is that the idea?
You do. Uh-huh. And we designated everything that went into the river wilderness so that it wouldn't be developed. It would be only primitive camping.
No fires.
Backpackers. No, you do build fires.
Oh, you do?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, what about scrabbling around for fuel? Is that a good thing?
No problem, because north aspects is where usually there's springs and vegetation and trees, and you have wood. But now, backpackers carry little gas stoves and for convenience and less risk of a fire not being put out properly. And
would you approve of a luxury lodge or two on the edge of the canyon?
You said the worst thing in the world. No way.
No.
But that is usually what happens.
Yeah. What would that do besides cause parking problems?
Well, all those things bring about what most people are already doing. You know, we go to the coast, people look for big fancy hotel, motel, parked on the cliff.
Hot showers and clean sheets.
That's right. Yeah. It's exactly.
So why isn't that compatible with Hell's Canyon?
Because that can be done nearly everywhere else but Hell's Canyon.
Well, you should suffer a little when you go to Hell's Canyon?
A lot, and enjoy every bit of it.
Now that's going to be hard to sell.
There really are.
You'll enjoy it more if you suffer more.
We have generations of new outdoorsmen that are put an old outdoorsman like me to shame.
I'm aware of that.
They're really.
But then that's discriminatory. Isn't that the argument?
They throw that out, but it's.
Why should only these rugged guys and women be the ones to enjoy it? Why shouldn't the rest of the people enjoy it?
That's why I mentioned to you at our dedication at Buckhorn, there were people that challenged us on that very thing.
And do you have any comeback?
Yes, you can do just what you got right here, and you have a Hell's Canyon, but there are maps that have, just like the Indian Reservation or the Crater Lake National Park, the only one we got in Oregon, and
thousands of people can run up to the edge of the lake easily.
They do that.
Yeah.
And they do cause the problem that man has is not to know how to respect a fragile environment. And pretty soon, those pristine places that we want to kind of protect are no longer. There's soil erosion, compactions, and
I understand that, but how do you defend yourself against the charge that you really are an elitist?
Well, I have done my share of that, but that's why we have enough educated people that will support the upcoming legislation that we want to change from a public agency from Department of Agriculture to a Department of Interior.
So I guess the argument would go, well, if we get enough people, thousands of people, who say that we need to preserve the canyon the way it is, and we need to restrict access, we need to make it somewhat difficult to get there, the very fact that there are thousands of people who believe that means that it's not an elitist position. Is that
would
be accurate?
That's exactly what has happened.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a matter of defining elitist in a different way. You don't have to get, make it such that 98% of the population is able to get to the lip of the canyon and look over. Because 98% never will, in your view, I gather.
It is something.
Maybe 25%?
25% would be a possibility of still having the landscape survive. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have any way of estimating how many people, approximately how many people a year could get or could travel these trails around the canyon without inflicting a lot of damage?
We know Yellowstone gets 3 million plus visitors, but they can hardly wait to close the gate about now, and then there's a different use that is very objectionable, and that's snowmobiling.
Yeah.
But it's only the park doesn't open until June, so our landscape out here is available to the public the year round from somewhere. You may not go to the 10 foot of snow on the top of the ridge at Half Point, but you can go up to 1,200 feet on the river level, and it's open the year round, and the Native Americans taught us that over millions of years. So technically, it can be used more year round than any other environment that I know of, really. Glacier Park, same thing, it's closed this week and won't open until next June. So it's only used for 4 or 5 months, and here this one goes from 12,000 to 8,000.
What? 8,000
in elevation.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of numbers of visitors, if it's open year round, could you get as many as 3 million people there without damaging it?
No, because those darn automobiles benefit probably 2/3 of that 3 million. Yeah. 1 million are the only ones that really would, if they didn't have wheels, they'd only be 1 million visitors.
Well, let's say that they didn't park the automobiles in a place that was going to be damaging. They were just tramping around on the trails and going however they could get down to the river. Would the number of visitors that could be accommodated number in the millions, or is it much less than that?
It probably wouldn't without extensive Yellowstone. I've hiked most of it, and it's rather gentle terrain, except for the Yellowstone Falls and their chasm they have, which is a small fraction of what we have out here. I think they would do damage. All right.
I have not been to Grand Canyon either, but
I haven't either.
It's much larger.
Yes.
And I'm sure there are many millions of people who go there every
Good
year
comparison.
And go down the trail to the bottom, and I guess there's a lodge of some kind down there.
There is.
And
you can ride a mule if you want to.
So are there any lessons from the way people have been using Grand Canyon that could be applied to Hell's Canyon?
If it were the winter months of the Grand Canyon are very popular, because that's where this old retired and boy and his wife go, and is warm Arizona weather. Up here we have snow all winter long around the outside. They don't have that, but then they have heat in the summer that people can't bear, so they're not as prevalent. But they're thinking of the automobiles already overdone itself many years ago, so they are considering a railroad out to the canyon rim that will carry 500 people and not 500 automobiles. So they're having to change their management. We would like to not have anything as drastic as building a paved road down the top of the ridge on both sides in Idaho and Oregon. But it could come to that. Yeah. Forest Service on the Oregon side, Rick, Brett were out there hiking just last week to resurvey the violations that they're that motorized people are doing on designated wilderness, because they don't respect designated wilderness.
Well, what's the commercial interest in having highways come in to get to the jet boats?
No, it's just the rim. It's on the tops where people can do what they do at Grand Canyon, at Yellowstone, at Glacier Park, is to drive to a parking lot and look out over the most pristine landscape, and that's all that they do there. And that's what nearly all of those areas do.
Would that involve charging admission? Is that the commercial benefit of doing it?
They do.
Mm-hmm.
And they.
You don't have to pay anything when you go to Half Point, do you?
No, there is no charge.
But there are other places where you do have to pay admission.
Yes, there are. Mm-hmm.
Are they on the mainly on the Idaho side?
Not really. It's mostly river activity that they request some.
That's what I thought maybe.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but you said they were up on the rim, not down by the river. So how does that?
Well, when you're up on the rim, again, it's like I mentioned. It closes in end of elk season is the 1st of December, and then 4th of July is a rule of thumb for automobile access at the rims on both Idaho and Oregon side. And of the NRA to be closed, but Forest Service is not cooperating. That's why we think we have to change agencies in order to have the area and the wildlife that we hope that we will have wolf visitation and start using Oregon for expanding their population, and they can't if they have wolf right through the wolf, the gray wolf. If we have it's kind of ahead of its prediction for establishment in Idaho and Montana, and we've had Idaho wolf visit Oregon, but the cattlemen insisted on the animal being tranquilize and move back, and we did that. Mm-hmm. But he will be back again because that's the nature of the animal. Only Oregon is, cattlemen have already said the animal will be destroyed if he comes to Oregon. So we're in a stage of educating the public. We had a great, big, successful meeting right here at the college in a big auditorium where 350 people and their kids came, and a real rehabilitated from being the wolf had been hurt and needed rehabilitation, and so they were actually had the live wolf there as well as showing pictures of and slides, and a very interesting, fascinating program, and it went over really, really great.
There seems to be quite a bit of emotional appeal to the wolf.
There is.
As people understand more about the wolf's tenacity and habits.
We've been under a cloud of hundreds of years of despising the wolf, and he wasn't of that nature at all. So it's really pretty exciting. Mm-hmm. And we think that we, last turkey season, we brought my family of five boys, and I have promoted wild turkey introduction. Oregon never did have wild turkey. Now we have wild turkey in every county in Oregon. And so we think wolf scat out in our turkey hunting area in the corner of Oregon, right at the edge of the NRA, and we have lots of turkeys on the NRA, but we think Idaho wolf already came into that part of the Oregon and probably went back to get a mate. So next turkey season, it's very likely we'll hear a wolf howl in the corner of Oregon again.
And you don't mind giving the wolves a few turkey dinners?
Don't mind at all.
Is that a natural prey? Do they normally prey on wolves? I mean, on turkeys?
We...
In other parts of the country?
Yes, they were wolf and turkey from the crest of the Rocky Mountains clear to the East Coast. Pilgrim time, and wolves were the same thing. So, and we have several artists that make paint pictures of wolves and bobcat, lynx, sneaking up on a turkey that is decides, hey, I'm going to be eaten if I don't fly. So it's it. We're sure that wolves know how good a turkey are to eat.
Even
and
wrong.
Cougar, we've had 8 cougar come into our decoys when we're calling in turkeys because they have learned that turkeys are good eating. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to take a break?
No, I. But okay. Do you?
No.
We can do that.
Sure.
But we don't want that. Rick was supposed to talk.
Oh, he didn't tell me that.
Is that right? Okay, I just had the opinion that he was, and I didn't want to use up all of your valuable time.
Well, it's all right. I'd like to take you back to the time when you were a business owner here in La Grande, and undoubtedly you found yourself unpopular on some occasions.
A lot.
Do you recall maybe 2 or 3 conversations you had with other business people?
My wife reminds me because I didn't happen to come to my store. I had an errand to do it
that
one
was
morning at 8 a.m.
Bernie's Jewelry, wasn't it?
Bernie's Jewelry.
I knew Gene Bernie slightly.
You know, I came through that door and I wanted to give you a hug like I have met you before.
Oh, yes, well, it's possible.
And now you pull just what I thought you could pull.
1951.
I've been here a year. September 1950 is when I came.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was it then.
George passed away in 3 weeks after I came to work for him.
Mm-hmm.
He went, I didn't have anything to do but work till midnight every night. So I had all of his 2 months of watchmaking work all cleared up, and he looked at me and he said, this hasn't happened in the last 40 years. He said, I'm going to take my first vacation, and Gene and I are going over to Boise, where, think of his name, I'll think of it. He was the Greyhound mechanic, and he would work on George's old car.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they transferred him to Boise. He said, I'm going over to have my car worked on by my friend, and by dang, Gene called and said, Lauren, George passed away last night. And that was the most heartbreaking thing there ever was, because I was to learn a lot of things from that old boy.
Mm-hmm.
First licensed optometrist in the state of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Neatest people in the world.
I know she was. This is one of the 2 rings that came from the store.
I can't believe that.
Well, you have to.
That is just something.
Well, it gives us a bond we didn't know we had.
It really does.
Because
she stuck it out for 5 years. She'd never been in the store. And she just finally looked at me and just said, why don't you and Betty buy my store so that I can enjoy the rest of my life the way that I was supposed to. And I never realized that she hadn't helped George or anything. And she was the most inspirational person that anybody has ever met.
Yeah, that's right.
She really gave me the outdoor ethics that I have and have tried to improve on, and I don't think you could improve on her outdoor ethic.
Tell me a little more about that. I think I knew that she was oriented that way, but I didn't know anything in detail about it. Was she a hiker?
You bet. But her dad was the first doctor in the county, lived at Cove, where they, to come to La Grande, they the valley was one big lake.
Yeah.
So they had to go around through Union on the Foothill Road and everything. Well, she told those stories, but so she was on a horse before she could walk, and she, her and Gerda Brownton, her Jean Reese that she, and Jean and was a sister, the McKinnon family, Jean raised, because their mother passed away, so Jean raised Dallas McKinnon, all that. Well, all that was just, and they called themselves the Girl Scout, see, what they have a, I've said it 100 times. Antique Girl Scouts. For 80 years, they packed into the Minim, and the Minim was more sacred to the Bernese and to all those women than really was to any Native American. They protected that canyon more than anybody. And, You brought in a secret time bomb. How'd you let him do?
Get on a call there, and now I have to get to town before 4 o'clock to get down here. So I'm going to take off, but I'm going to come right back.
You
can apologize for jumping in and out, you guys.
That's right.
You brought in a guy on me.
he didn't know
that is known Mrs. Bernie.
Oh, are you kidding? No kidding.
Right. Even got that ring. I couldn't believe that.
But I want to know how she conveyed this ethic of the wilderness and nature to you.
She had a way of interviewing you or listening to your use of the outdoors, and if you didn't quite meet her ethics, she had the neatest way to visit with you. About
she
doing it this way.
She wouldn't confront you.
No.
A more subtle approach than that.
More subtle than that.
Yeah.
She was really the ultimate of outdoor. And there are many stories that have been written, and I have quite a few of them, about her outdoor ethics and about her. She actually was one of the 150 that testified for the Minim. And everybody stood up and applauded. When that old girl, they knew that was...
She knew.
Knew.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That's exactly right. You know, she always had a dog, and like all of them, they got older. She cooked in the fireplace. I lived with her, by the way. When George died, she just said, why are you staying down here in a little apartment? I have an extra bedroom.
You were single.
And I went up and moved in until I gave my wife a ring and got married on Thanksgiving Day. And but she would cook. No Native American could cook on an open fire like she could. Huh. So she was cooking and squatted down and got up, and the dog had gone up and sat down behind her. And when she stood up, she was 87, she fell over the dog and broke her hip. And like too often, she couldn't get over that.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to get back to your confrontations with businessmen or business people around here.
I had the Baker Yamaha dealer come over from Baker with three of his...
This was Yamaha vehicles, not Yamaha pianos.
Yamaha snowmobiles and ATVs.
Yes.
And they were picketing the front of my store, and I wasn't there yet. And my wife just
What would they call you? A goddamn environmentalist?
Yes, that's exactly right. Uh-huh. Yeah, it was just exactly that. Mm-hmm. And by golly, before I come to about quarter after, the local judge, Warner Wasley, had coffee on across the street from Bernie's Jewelry, and he was going back to his office, and he came across the street, could see what was happening, and he told the Yamaha dealer that he was, that I had all of my rights, and that he was violating several city ordinances in picketing my business. And he wasn't that close a friend or acquaintance, but he had enough ethics about him, and that guy packed up his paraphernalia and all his picketing and his signs and took his friends, and they left. And
Did they talk to you? Did the picketer talk to you? When I got there, they had...
The judge had threatened them that they were illegal, and they had left, and my wife told me about...
You must have seen the picketer out there before the judge arrived.
I didn't.
Oh, you didn't.
My wife did. She was putting the jewelry in the window for the display of the day.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, that was one thing Mrs. Bernie Jean liked to do. She was so artistic. She could put in the prettiest windows, and they were always the first buttercup of the year. She knew only where they grew, and she became a legend. Everybody knew they could look in the window in the first week of February and see the very first buttercup of Eastern Oregon.
Yeah.
She'd have it in the window.
That's a good example of a subtle way to remind people of the presence of nature.
She was good.
Yeah.
She could do just exactly that.
Were you picketed only once?
Well, I was trying to think. I can almost remember some other irate situations.
Did you hear about them secondhand, or did they're often? Would they're often?
Well, I always had lots of secondhand.
They wouldn't come up right to you and discuss it?
Not very often, hardly. I can't hardly remember more than a few times. I don't know if I had a mannerism that kept them from doing it, but I would hear, other people would go to public meetings, and I wouldn't be there, but I'd be chastised, and then they'd come and tell me, well, this was this and this was that. But I kind of expected it, so I didn't think anything of it, really. But a lot of it was because I was inspired so much by Jean Bernie that I could take anything anybody wanted to hand out.
She was there at your side.
All the time.
In your mind. Like a guardian angel.
And my having horses was like her having horses, and so we really enjoyed telling each other's experiences month after month after month, and we kind of understood each other, but I never was a horseman. Horses, my cousins would make me ride a bareback horse, knowing that I'd fall off. So I never had any love for horses till Jean Bernie.
Well, as you felt this disagreement or outright opposition to your views, did it become more difficult to hang on to them?
No, it never. It really got stronger, and it still is stronger than ever because of people like Rick and they've all been so inspirational to me. That it just actually, but I don't sleep as good at night as I used to because of the volumes and volumes and volumes of conservation projects that need to be accomplished, you know.
What exactly are you doing now about the conservation project?
Well, All of my conservation friends are very inspirational in keeping this old boy around. I don't really do that much good. These lovely girls are part of that whole thing.
Well, they might not like to be called girls.
Yes, they would.
They go get on those computers and start getting money, and they start.
Well, what do you
getting,
do then? Do you mainly inspire them?
They say that, but sometimes I wonder.
Are you up here often?
Yep, I am.
Mm-hmm. What, do you just sit around and chat, or do you?
No way. They don't let me get by with that.
Oh,
but
well, what do you do then?
Really, we always have an appeal on gold mining operations, or would have something that.
So you're working on.
They'll jump in my pickup and.
An approach to.
Brett goes with me, and we go up and look at Mount Hood and Matt Adams from up here on a high spot. But here's ATVs have cut all of our ranchers' fences, and we take pictures of them. So I come back, and this office writes up a letters and legal documents that make me look good.
But I should think the ATV riders and the ranchers are both on the wrong side, aren't they?
They are both on the wrong side. But we're trying to get on the side of the rancher because of the destruction of his new fence was destroyed.
Yeah, but you're making the best of a bad thing, is that?
Yes, that's
I like that. I understand compromise. That's what it is, isn't it? Compromise a lot of the time.
It is just that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But conservationists have been doing too much of that, compromising.
Especially once paid by the government.
And especially.
Is anybody writing up a history of all of this? Or taking notes for a history?
I think there is definitely... a nice file. Rick always says, I can provide that historical information. And we were just asked that in Portland just this last Saturday. And Rick assured that we have all that documentation.
It seems to me that since in your mind there's a great deal of a history of this, and you have a broad perspective on what's been going on since the 1930s, approximately.
Yes, that's right.
That you probably are in a position, maybe with some help, to tell what really is an epic story. I mean, this is a large struggle, isn't it?
It is.
With many ramifications, many different players, many implications for centuries, probably.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. And it seems like it's only still in its infancy, mm-hmm. when we have a five-state wilderness proposal. Mm-hmm. You know, you take in lots of people in five states. Mm-hmm. So that's exactly right. Yeah. And that's what makes me sit up in my bed and eyes wide open and not able to sleep, because I don't have very many more years to go to see these things be finalized.
People around here living to 100, so why not you? Do you think that a history like this needs to be written from a neutral standpoint? I mean, a sort of a detached perspective, so that it's possible to try to state fairly what all sides are saying about Hell's Canyon and maybe the area as a whole? Or would you like to see a more partisan history?
Again, there isn't enough time to involve in educating and swinging people from the opposite viewpoint over. Old boy's has decided they're not worth spending any more time on, because
I
already spent
evil.
70 years doing that.
Of course, the purpose of a history is not usually to argue one side or the other. You can write history that way, but I wonder if you think maybe we've reached the point where a history of this struggle would be valuable if it were told from an essentially nonpartisan point of view.
Definitely, yeah. It really would do just that. That would be the Jean Burney approach.
Mm-hmm.
No?
Well, Jean Burney approach, I mean, she would certainly, at least subtly, indicate what her point of view
she
is.
She would do just that.
If she wrote the history, it would be largely from her perspective, I suppose.
She'd done just that.
Mm-hmm. I gather, though, that efforts going into the struggle are so consuming now that there isn't time for anybody here to write such a history. And maybe this is not the best place for a history to come from anyway.
No, I don't know why it wouldn't. There really isn't anybody that shouldn't have, that wouldn't benefit from it right from here. Really. It's just HCPC and their staff and people that we have around us are the best that there is.
Most informed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really important.
Yeah, it is, really. No, it is. Nope, it would be.
Have all of the, I suppose this is an obvious question, or the answer should be obvious, but have all of the facets of Hell's Canyon as it was and the various damages that have been occurred to him been documented by photographs?
Yep, there has been.
You've got thousands of them?
Yes.
Amateur photographs?
Yes.
Any aerial?
Yes, I had friends that have taken me on airplane rides lots of times.
To take photographs?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then that helped with some of my appeals on resource damage.
That's what I wondered. Do the photographs show clearly the effects of human intrusion?
Definitely.
And can you arrange them chronologically so that you can see from the photographs how it was? I mean, obviously not before the homesteaders got there, but, and you said they had already overgrazed by the early part of the 20th century, but would some of the photographs show it close to what it might originally have been?
I have a cousin that was his job to do transect of over a 100-year period, and he's published a couple books. And
of just that area?
99 to 100 years ago, and then the present day, mm-hmm. and it was done on transects. And Gifford Pinchot is even in one of the pictures 100 years ago, and then 100 years later, a transect picture on the same site. And there's about 70 some of those in this book. Mm-hmm. So their Forest Service has a lot of those, and they've he was able to go get that. And then the Forest Service did do just what you just said, and they didn't influence his comments and his 100-year later response. He reread the vegetation and documented the vegetation 100 years later. So those are available. And then Rick has just recently, for some lawsuits that are pending, showed us just last Saturday that are astounding photographs.
I should think they would be very good objective evidence for the case.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Are there detailed captions and explanations to go with them, written?
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. The Forest Service wrote them?
Yep,
yep,
they did. But really, Rick's attorney has written more recent ones in order to go to court and represent the cause.
What aspects of this whole story have we not covered, especially the older parts? Let's restrict it to your own direct personal observations. There are probably parts of the chronology of your involvement in this whole matter that we haven't touched on.
Why I'm drawing a blank on.
Do you remember the first time you saw Hell's Canyon?
Probably it's alarming to think that maybe I never really seen very much of the Hell's Canyon because for 30 years probably, because we had something more aesthetic in the Eagle Cap Wilderness. Just like Mrs. Burney, I'm not sure that she'd ever been to Hat Point or anywhere because she didn't go anywhere that she did.